With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Welcome back to Key Battles of the Pacific War on Film. This is your host, James. And as always, I've got Sean McIver with me. Sean, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm here.
You're here. Yeah. Sean has been under the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody be patient with Sean. If his voice isn't quite where it needs to be, it's because he hasn't been feeling well and he's recovering, but he's being a real trooper and is going to do this with me anyway. We are going to discuss a fascinating movie today and a very different movie from all the other ones we've talked about so far. This is not just a typical war movie. It's not an action flick by any stretch of the imagination. It does have plenty of combat in it, and there is some action, but there is so much more. The movie we're discussing is The Thin Red Line from 1998. Oh, what an interesting movie. I don't know if I'm even really up to discussing this one. It's so deep, but we're going to give it a shot anyway. Sean will help me out, of course. Let's talk about the basics as we always do. This is a pretty long movie. Quite long. The length is 2 hours and 50 minutes, 5-0. So it's almost 3 hours. It's been generally well received by the critics as well as by the general public. On Rotten Tomatoes, it got an 80% positive rating from the critics and 80% from the fans. So they completely agree. That's kind of rare. On IMDb, it got an average rating of 7.6, which is quite respectable. The director is Terrence Malick. And Sean will give you some more information about Terrence Malick. He's a very fascinating director, and his movies are fascinating. But anyway, I don't want to keep saying that. I don't want to sound like a broken record. So I will move on to the cast. And it has an amazing cast. The cast of this movie had quite a few people who were already established stars, and then quite a few others who would later become stars. People like Sean Penn, Adrian Brody, Jim Caviezel, Ben Chaplin, George Clooney, John Cusack, Woody Harrelson, Elias Koteas, Jared Leto, or I don't know if I said that right. Is that pronounced right, Sean?
I think it's Jared Leto.
Leto, okay. Nick Nolte and John Travolta. And it's based on the 1962 novel of the same name by James Jones. And that novel is a fictionalized account of the Battle of Mount Austin, which is part of the Guadalcanal campaign. This battle took place toward the end of the Guadalcanal campaign. It was December 1942 to January 1943. The Thin Red Line was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, based on material previously produced or published, Best Cinematography, Best Film Editing, Best Original Dramatic Score. It was scored by Hans Zimmer, and Best Sound. And it did not win any of them. It completely struck out, at least at the Academy Awards, but it did win many other awards. Martin Scorsese, who knows a thing or two about movies, he ranked it as his second favorite film of the entire decade of the 1990s. And on At the Movies, the famous reviewer Gene Siskel called it the greatest contemporary war film I've seen. And that is high praise because Gene Siskel saw a lot of movies and a lot of war movies in particular. Right, Sean, tell us a little bit more about the background.
Well, so Terrence Malick was a product of as an American filmmaker, he was a product of the 1970s New Hollywood movement, which came along And some of the famous directors and filmmakers from that new Hollywood movement were Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Michael Cimino, Brian De Palma, Steven Spielberg, Robert Altman really rose. It started in the 60s, but really it was prominently in the early 70s. And this was the breaking of the studio system, where young filmmakers from film school, rather than tradesmen who'd come up through the film industry, film students broke into the film industry. And Malick was one of those. He emerged as one of the most intellectual and idiosyncratic of those filmmakers. He released two films, one of which was the sparse 1973 crime spree film Badlands, about Charles Starkweather, based on Charles Starkweather. This movie made Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek stars. And then in 1978, he released a film called Days of Heaven, which is an arty, dreamy, semi-Western starring Richard Gere, as well as Sam Shepard. Now, after Days of Heaven, Malick spent nearly two decades not making films or not completing any films. He started a number of aborted projects, but didn't really release anything, although apparently he filmed stuff during the entire time, just different projects and different things he worked on. He also cultivated a legend about his maverick talent, and most of the time he actually was living in Austin. That was where he went to high school, was in Austin. So he lived in Texas for a number of years. In 1988, he began work adapting James Jones's 1962 war novel, The Thin Red Line. And there was actually a film in the 60s that was based on this novel that was released, and it's a much more straightforward, classical, war movie. But Malick had loved the novel, and he wanted to create a film from that. So he took about 7 years to research and write a screenplay and spend his production partner's money. He spent several hundred thousand dollars of their money, as well as a couple of million dollars of some other partners' money working on other projects. So he would travel around and film stock footage and just do a lot of research, meet with people. And finally, in 1995, after years of badgering by his partners, they finally just said, you've got to make a film. And so they made a deal with Fox Pictures, who put up $40 million for him to make the film. But the condition was that he had to cast five known movie stars in the film. And so as a result, he began working on producing the film, and the casting process was astounding because there was hundreds of actors in Hollywood who had admired his work and they wanted to be part of this film. As soon as the news hit that Malick was making another movie, every single star in Hollywood, every single male star, especially since he was making a war movie, they wanted to be part of this film. So his friend Sean Penn told Malick, give me a dollar and tell me where to show up. John Travolta had been up for the lead part in Days of Heaven, and he had not gotten it because of other commitments. And so Richard Gere got it, but he was friends with Malick as well, and Malick promised to give him a part in the film. So among the actors who were interested in this film, there's past and future Oscar winners Robert De Niro, Robert Duvall, Brad Pitt, Gary Oldman, Bruce Willis, as not an Oscar winner, but he was a big star, Kevin Costner, Leo DiCaprio, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Edward Norton, Matthew McConaughey, Nicolas Cage, Al Pacino, they all lobbied for parts. Tom Cruise and Johnny Depp lobbied for, tried to get walk-on parts in the film, even if they couldn't get parts. They met with Malick. Bruce Willis flew the casting agents to his film location, first class, just to meet with them. Bill Pullman and Mickey Rourke, Lucas Haas, and Gary Oldman actually were cast, and some of them even filmed some scenes, but they actually ended up being cut from the film. So The list of people who wanted to be in this movie was, and that weren't in this movie, is probably the greatest almost cast in history, film history.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was watching, and didn't you say, I don't know if you wanted to get to this now or later, but didn't he film just hours and hours and hours and hours?
He filmed thousands of hours of film, thousands and thousands of feet of film, hundreds of hours of film. There is more that is cut from this film then made it to the screen.
Yeah, he could have made it into like a Band of Brothers-esque.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he really, something. Well, and a lot of it is second unit stuff and is close-up shots of birds and flowers and things like that. So, what you see on the screen though, but he actually had multiple cuts of the film at different points during the editing process. So it is very interesting, the filmmaking process in this film. The other thing is that Malick was it was very iconoclastic in his filming. So the production ran for 100 days in Australia, then 24 days on the Solomon Islands. They actually wanted to film in Guadalcanal, but they were worried everyone would get malaria. And so he was talked out of it. Although he took some trips to Guadalcanal itself to see the actual locations. He also filmed 3 days in the United States for reshoots. He actually had clauses in his contract to bar his production partners from being able to set foot on his set. They actually tried to go to the set and they were barred from the set when they got there. They didn't even realize that was in his contract that he signed with Fox. So he didn't want any interference. This was his film. And then he's one of the few filmmakers who have final cut in film. So final cut is a very coveted thing that directors seek to have. And 99% of directors don't get it unless they actually, you know, make the film themselves or they pay for their executive producers of the film. Like Steven Spielberg has final cut in most of his films, but that's because he has his own film studio, basically. Most famously, Stanley Kubrick had final cut on all of his films. So he actually went round and Malick went round and round with the studio about his cut and threatened not to release his film in many cases unless they released the film that he wanted to make. Yeah, so he and cinematographer John Toll, they shot hundreds of hours of film, thousands of feet of film. They would shoot a scene in the morning when it was bright and then maybe finish that scene several weeks later at sunset to give a juxtaposition of in the scene. He also made a habit of turning the camera away from action scenes so that he could film some piece of fauna that was happening while maybe in the background of the ridge was exploding or something like that. He wanted to capture birds flying away or things like that. And there's a method to his madness in that he had a specific story that he's wanting to tell about the intersection of war and nature and mankind. So his methods actually he had a lot of respect among his cast. They actually had a boot camp for all of the actors before filming started. And so to get them all into shape because they would be out in the jungle for 100 days. But Woody Harrelson and John Savage, who are both two of the older actors actually at the time in the film, they stayed for an extra month without pay just so they could watch him work. And a number of actors, Gary Oldman and other actors, came in, just flew in just to see him work, just to see him doing his thing. So it was an interesting time for film because this was a person who'd made two highly respected films and had not done anything for 20 years.
Yeah, that's simply amazing to me. This is his third film, and he's just seen as this Michelangelo, this master.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really.
All right. Well, we'll start into the plot summary. There's so much more than the plot summary in this one, though. But I don't know that we'll be able to scratch the surface. It would take us hours and hours to get into everything. But it's a stunningly beautiful and just highly visual film. There's just so many parts where there's just a shot of just two people just sitting there, their faces, or or birds, like you already mentioned, Sean, or water, or the beautiful trees. It's just amazing.
It's a deeply contemplative film for a war film, especially the first act and the third act. The second act is really where all the action is, or most of the action is. But I think in the first act, definitely, it's a very contemplative, philosophical, introspective scene.
Yeah, it's just total opposite of, we just did Midway last time, and that's just the action, 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 you know, no characters are like 1 inch thick, you know, but they're not in this one. Anyway, so it starts out, the first thing you see is an alligator, and the alligator just gradually descends into the swamp, and then you're taken to this just almost like a paradise, this natural paradise where everything just seems to be pristine and perfect. And you're on, now we're not sure, Sean and I disagree about the location, but it's definitely not with the, where all the soldiers are and everything. You're on, it's either, Sean thinks it's another island. I think it's part of Guadalcanal, and I'll explain why.
In retrospect, I think it is. I think it maybe is like the southeast side of the island or southwest side of the island, because the action, the combat all took place pretty much from Henderson Field north, which is, Henderson Field is on the east shore, the northeast shore of the island. Guadalcanal is an island that's kind of shaped like a kidney bean. And the main action was over this airfield, which became Henderson Field, that the Japanese originally built. And so on the kind of, if you think of a bean, the kind of the indentation on the top part is really where the northeast side of the island would be, and that's Henderson Field. So I think it's probably like on the far south tip of the island, because he does have to take a canoe to get out there with his friend.
Yeah, and so there's two U.S. soldiers who have gone AWOL. They've run away. One of them, and this is arguably the main character of the entire film. There's a lot of characters in this film, a lot, but many of them don't even hardly have a line. They might have one or two lines, and you see their faces a lot, but you don't see them. But this character is Private Witt, W-I-T-T, Witt, and he's played by Jim Caviezel, who I love. I love Jim Caviezel. I know he's controversial because he's conservative. He's a traditionalist Roman Catholic, and he played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ. And he's friends with Mel Gibson, so that's several strikes against him in a lot of people's eyes. But I think he's good. I've seen him in several movies, and then he played in a TV series that I love called Person of Interest, which came out like 2010 or so and ran for about 5 or 6 years. But anyway, Private Witt is a very simple man in some ways. He smiles all the time. He seems to be pure of heart, but at the same time, he's kind of a screw up, and he's a guy. Later on in the movie, one character says, well, when they say turn left, you turn right. And he can't be constrained. He can't be held in one place. And so he's gone AWOL with a friend of his, Private Train, T-R-A-I-N, just like a train. And so they're living with the easygoing and seemingly carefree Melanesian natives, probably on a different portion of Guadalcanal. But paradise can't last forever. You know, nothing good can stay, as one of the poets said. And eventually, here comes a transport boat looking for him and Train, and he's found, and he's imprisoned on a troop carrier by his company sergeant, first sergeant, and that is Sergeant Welsh. And that is Sean Penn's character. And Sean Penn, what can we say about Sean Penn? Sean MacIver, he's a legend.
Yeah, he was actually between Oscar wins at that point in 98, but he looks... Yeah, he'd been in film for, you know, nearly 20 years at that point, but he still looks really young in this film.
Yeah. But
he's in his mid to late 30s, I think, at this point in his life. So, but yeah, I was watching it the other day, and I was like, oh gosh, he looks so young compared to what he looks now. He looks pretty old now.
Yeah, but his character, this first sergeant, he was the top sergeant's platoon, and he's right. One of the older of the young men and that are.
Yeah,
he's the grizzled veteran. You know, that's a character you see a lot in movies. But
well, and then in this scene, he and several of the soldiers, including Witt, make mention of the fact that they're army regulars. They are not recent recruits.
Right.
Most of them, especially you know, as a sergeant Welsh, but even Witt, you know, he says Witt, you've been in this army for
like
four
6 years.
Years
or something.
6 years,
like that.
Yeah. So like these are not new recruits who signed up on December 8th, 1941. You know, some of them are, I'm sure, but a number of them is the cadre of regular, you know, U.S. Army infantry that's been, you know, sent to the combat zone. So, you know, these are not, you know, a lot of these are not, I mean, they're not combat veterans, obviously, but they, you know, they're definitely Army regulars.
Yeah. And the relationship between these two men is one of the main things that goes on in the movie. It goes on throughout the entire film. Other characters come and go, but these two are there for they go the distance. And Welsh, Sean Penn's character, is a very hard bitten, grizzled man. He's very cynical. He doesn't believe, he's not a spiritual man at all. He often says in the book and the movie that this whole war is about property. That's all it is. That's just property. Mm-hmm. Whereas Jim Caviezel's character, Witt, is very spiritual, not necessarily in a strictly Christian way. He's kind of got more of a transcendentalist kind of
viewpoint. That's the word I'm thinking of. That's what I was thinking about. He's transcendental. He's very above it.
And we should mention an interesting feature of this movie. And I think Terrence Malick does this, well, at least in two movies. I've seen his movie, The New World, which is a very fictionalized account of the Jamestown settlement. They have these voiceovers there too. But one of the main features of the movie are these voiceovers. So you get to know what the characters are thinking by just hearing their voice. And they might be marching through a field, or they might just be sitting there staring at a tree. But Witt gets a lot of them. Welsh gets a couple.
Dash Mahook's character also gets one. There's a scene later where he says, like, You killed a man. That's the worst thing you can do. He's thinking. He's not speaking. So you do get the narrative technique is first person. It's not omniscient. It's limited to the thinker, to the person thinking.
Yeah. But anyway, like I said, this relationship between the spiritual man, the man of faith, wit, and the man of, I guess, cynicism and experience, and the man that believes that there's just this world, that's it.
Yeah.
That would be Welsh. And it makes for an interesting dynamic. And they sit down and they have a conversation. And you can tell the two men respect each other and they kind of like each other, but they're so different, you know.
Welsh doesn't trust Witt.
Yeah, Witt says, I'm twice the man that you are. And really, that's the only even halfway mean thing he says throughout the entire movie. He's very much, Sean and I were talking about this in a previous conversation we had offline or online, but not in this recording. And that is that Witt is kind of a Christ-like figure, a Christ figure, I should say. More on that later. But so they talk, and finally, Witt is a subject to court-martial, of course, because he's gone AWOL, but Welsh works a deal for him because he likes him, and he says, you're going to have to go out of the company that they're all a part of, his company C, Charlie Company, and he's going to be made a stretcher bearer. Now, I should mention, too, that the men of C Company, they're in the 25th Infantry Division. They've been brought to Guadalcanal as reinforcements. This is not an initial invasion. Mm-hmm. This is the Marines showed up in early August of 1942, and this is about 4 months later. So
it would have been first Marines, right?
First Marine Division, yeah. They were the initial people that came in, and there were some Raider units as well. There were some paratroopers. Eventually, they were relieved by the Army. That's a fairly common pattern we see in the Pacific War. So these guys are coming in to, first of all, hold down what the Marines have already taken, but there's still some parts that need to be taken. The Japanese are still controlling Mount Austin and some areas around it, which are south of Henderson Field, which is the little part that Sean was talking about earlier. So anyway, they're going in. They're going to, try to kick out the rest of the Japanese and finally get the island secure. And so now we go back to the present. The thing with when Witt, well, I know, actually, I guess it's going back because the part with Witt and Train with the natives, that would have occurred after the initial invasion, right? I don't know.
Right. I think that maybe they did. So what I think is that they've landed at Henderson Field, and then they're going, the next amphibious landing is to get behind the, and there may be some liberties taken here also with history.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, the battle itself, the 25th Infantry Division landed and then went into battle against the Japanese in the positions, the Mount Austin position, or the Anthill, as it was mm-hmm. called. But I think that they were already on Guadalcanal, or they were, that's why I was thinking it might be Tulagi that they were at, because that was an anchorage across the channel from Guadalcanal, where a lot of the American ships would go first before going over into the combat zone. So who knows? I mean, it's Malik wanted to have a landing, with the Higgins boat. So
I've seen this movie four times and I still don't know exactly what's going on in every situation, but
I think some liberties,
I think that's by design,
based on the battle. That's the main thing.
Yeah, and I should say that the book, the novel that this is based on the author's actual experience. The author, James Jones, was part of this division, and he actually participated in this battle. So, there's one of the characters, Corporal Fife, is based on James Jones himself. So that's just kind of an interesting fact. So we see the men, they're down in the cargo area, not the cargo area, but they're the area where they have their bunks and everything. And it's the typical thing you see in every movie like this and every book. And it's because it's based on the truth. These men are about to land. They don't really know what to expect when they land on the island, and some of them are reading, some of them are just trying to sleep, some of them are praying, some of them are playing cards, they're contemplating their lives.
Some of them are freaking out while they're shaving.
Exactly, yeah. And one of them, whose name is Dahl, D-O-L-L, Dahl, he steals a pistol. So there's
that's Dash Mahook. That's Dash Mahook.
Yeah, he's the redheaded guy.
Yeah. He was in Romeo and Juliet, the Leonardo DiCaprio Romeo and Juliet, and he's in a ton of movies.
I actually saw that recently and I don't remember him, but I'm sure.
Yeah. He plays Romeo's friend. The one, the scene where they said, "Do you want to draw a sword? I shall draw my sword."
Okay.
Yeah. That's Dash. He was a kind of a character, kind of a young character actor of that era, mm-hmm. That time period. But yeah, he's trying to get it. He's the one who says later, I killed a man. That's the worst thing I could do. So yeah, he's trying to get a pistol because enlisted men were not really supposed to have, sidearms.
Exactly.
I think that scene is great in the hold of the ship because it does show like just some of the ones are like, we've been in this army. If I'd known I was going to go to war, I wouldn't have signed up for the army. And,
right.
And the one kid that's talking to this freaking out while he's shaving, he's talking to Welsh. He's just rambling. We're going to survive this war. I know it, Sergeant.
Welsh
kind of shakes his head and is like,
that's actually Train. And it's interesting that Train just got stuck right back in the unit, whereas Wit was the, he got a punishment. I guess he was the ringleader of the two, I suppose. Well,
and I know that, if you were on administrative punishment or if you're waiting on a court martial or something in a combat area, a lot of times you were not allowed, you were made a stretcher bearer to keep you out, especially if you had conflict or something with the men on the line, or you were accused of cowardice or something like that. So stretcher bearers weren't always, and it wasn't actually, and even like sometimes I know they would empty out the brig, but they would, you would be pressed into service if you were on court martial or under arrest, general arrest, you would be made a stretcher bearer. So,
all right. Well, then we're taken up topside where we've been in the lower depth of the boat or the ship, and we've seen what the enlisted men are thinking. Now we go up topside and we meet the commander, and that is another major character in the movie, Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel Tall. And he is played by Nick Nolte. And he talks with his commanding officer, who is Brigadier General Quintard, played, strangely enough, by John Travolta. That's kind of an interesting casting. But they talk about the invasion and the importance. And then we have a voiceover from Tall in which we realize that he's been passed over for promotion. He feels bitter. He feels like he's sacrificed everything, including his family, for his country, and he hasn't been rewarded sufficiently, and he thinks that this battle is his last chance to command a victorious operation. And that's very important because that's going to affect his actions later when they actually do get into combat. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, yes. And he says that he has an adult son. He doesn't respect him and he won't look him in the eye. And he alludes to that his son won't join the military. And so they're both kind of mutually ashamed of each other. But yeah, John Travolta, as I said before, he tried to work with Malick for years and tried to get the part in Days of Heaven. And so, Malick was able to cast him as Brigadier General Quintard. And Nolte seems a bit too old to be a colonel, but I think that's the point. I think the point is that he's been in the army for he's got a lot of years in the army. And he's still this colonel, and he's been passed over. He's been passed over for command, and he's resentful of the fact that he feels like lesser men have gone past him. And I get the impression that Travolta seems kind of young to be a general, and although he was in his 40s at the time, but he seems kind of young. And so I think the impression that I always got was he resented Quintard, because Quintard had been one of those who'd passed him over. And Quintard even makes a comment like, you can't wait to get that star. You get that star and, it seems like it's forever before you getting that star. And that's the most important thing to you, getting that general star, and kind of rubs it in Tall's face is his way of motivating him to go do the things that he wants him to do. So I always felt like Nick Nolte's character was resentful of John Travolta's character for being one of those who passed him over. One of those lesser men who he had to, and he gives him a cigarette. He lights a cigarette for him. He kind of follows him around like a puppy because he has to. And he's kind of kowtowing to him. So,
right.
And he feels like he's prostituting himself to be able to continue to advance and to break through to that rank of general that he's coveted for so long.
Yeah, I agree.
Again,
Quintard is kind of weird. He's quirky and he gets right up in Colonel Tall's face and but you're right. I think he is kind of taunting him. He's taunting him about the possibility of him becoming a general too. He says, well, we're going to need good general officers, men with a lot of experience like you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Men with a lot of experience. And Tall's like, well, then why am I not a general already?
Yeah.
And so there creates a desperation in Tall to do this. you can tell through his thought process. He's desperate to have this, not just to have this glory, but to advance. Like it's not even glory that he seeks. It's just accomplishment. It's just this thing that he needs to do, this obstacle. And I think that's another thing that Malek is trying to show, is that war perverts natural things. The whole nature of the military is in service of war, whether there's a war going on or not. And so, whereas someone of quality and capability would naturally progress through any infrastructure and ecosystem, Malek is making a subtle comment about the military, that the brown nosers or that the egotists may advance over other people.
Yeah, you get 40-year-old generals and like 55-year-old lieutenant colonels.
Exactly.
All right, so let's move on to the next part. So the initial actions.
This is the second act, and this is really where all the real action in the film occurs.
Yes. C Company lands on Guadalcanal unopposed, and they march to the interior of the island. There they encounter natives, and they also see evidence of the Japanese presence and their tactics. For example, they see the mutilated corpses of some intercepted Marines and some Ranger scouts. That really did happen on Guadalcanal. There were incidents where U.S. Army soldiers and Marines found mutilated bodies, which was a common practice of the Japanese soldiers. Then they arrive at their objective, which is called Hill 210. It's a key Japanese position. I guess that's analogous to Mount Austin. I know in the book, the author deliberately changed the name of all the geographical features. And so I guess, I don't know if Hill 210 is equivalent to Mount Austin. Mount Austin is about 1,500 feet high. And the Marines had been on it a few times, but they kept leaving it. They never really tried to take it permanently. And the Japanese kept retaking it. So now it's up to the Army to get it and keep it. And the Japanese have placed a bunker housing several machine guns at the top of the hill, and that gives them a full view of the valley below. And I should say that, again, the scenery is just breathtakingly beautiful. It's realistic in that it has this grass, and I never can remember the name of the grass. It starts with a K. Sean, do you remember? It's that razor-sharp grass.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
It can go up to the height of a man or even higher, so it gives you good cover if you're the attacker. But not good enough to defeat this bunker. Any force attempting to climb the hill will be easily cut down by machine gun fire and mortar rounds. Colonel Tall.
Because there's a ridge. So the geography of the historical position down Mount Austin is actually very high. The hill that they assaulted where the anthill was is called the Gifu position. And that's where the bunkers were built. And it's a ridge in front of the downward slope of the mountain. But the thing is this ridge was a flat surface, and it allowed these artillery pieces to shell the airfield and the beachhead. And so there's a ridge leading up to kind of a star-shaped hill where there's different ridges going up towards the main ridge where the bunkers are. And that's and then there's an open field in front of them. And if you go directly up that field, you're going to get cut down. That's really what.
Yeah, I was oversimplifying the situations, but the fact of the matter is that the Company C is sent up there, and their commander is a man named Captain Staros. He's Greek, and he's played by Elias Koteas. I don't know if that's pronounced correctly. That's a Greek name. I think that's how you would say it in Greek, Koteas, but another character actor that's been in quite a few things. And Captain Staros. It, by the way, in the book, it's Stein. And I should stop and pause and say that in the book, every character has a single syllable name. And in the movie, that's almost true. There's a few exceptions. But did you notice that, Sean? The names are all like Welsh, Wit, Dahl, Dell, and all those other ones. But for whatever reason, I guess because Elias Koteas, the actor, is Greek, at the last minute I was reading, Malek decided to change the name of Captain Stein to Captain Staros, and supposedly his uniform still says Stein on it, although I wasn't able to see that. Interesting fun fact. But there begins to be a conflict between Colonel Tall, the overall commander, and the battalion commander, and Captain Staros, the company commander, because Captain Staros realizes that to do a full frontal assault on this position would be absolutely suicidal. Because of all the machine guns and the mortars and the fortified position the Japanese have. But Colonel Tall just doesn't seem to care. Captain Staros implies that he might want to do some kind of flanking maneuver, go around the side. And Colonel Tall says, oh, you can't do that. There's no way to do that. So he orders Captain Staros to send his company straight up this Ridge and to take out this position. And by the way, they're running out of water. That's another thing. But Tall says, you don't need water. You know, he says something like, the only time you need to worry about a GI is when they stop complaining or stop bitching, I think is what he says literally. Yeah. So the next day the attack is scheduled and Staros is a deeply, he's a caring man. He loves his men and he's also a deeply religious man. And so he's shaken by the difficulty of his assignment. And he spends the evening before the attack in prayer. It's a beautiful little part where they show a candlelight and he's praying and he says, don't let me fail you. But he knows he's been given an impossible task. Sean, do you want to jump in and say?
No,
and
Staros is Tall. He tries to argue with Tall, and Tall. Staros is a lawyer. It was a lawyer in his civilian life, and Staros says, don't try any courtroom tricks or whatever. But at any rate, Elias Koteas is a Canadian actor of Greek descent, so. He was a big time independent film actor in the early mid 90s. So he was a fairly decent star at the time.
Yeah. So dawn comes the next morning and the attack is scheduled. Staros asks the colonel via radio. The colonel's way back far behind the front line here, but he asked how much artillery support are we going to have? And Tall says two batteries of 105, so 105 millimeter. Staros says it won't be enough. And Tall replies very cynically, no, but it bucks the man up. It'll look like the Japs are catching hell. That's a direct quote. So it's all about looks.
Nick Nolte is so great in this film.
Oh, no. Nick Nolte is so good. Yeah. He's so cynical. You just can't stand him. And soon after, the shelling of the hill begins, and then the men start to line up and get ready. Not really line up, but they're preparing to go up. Then Sergeant Keck, one of the squad leaders, Woody Harrelson, just magically appears out of nowhere. It's kind of funny. Although I did notice they show him very briefly, just for about a second in the landing scene, what they show him on one of the landing boats. So this is, it's not like, go ahead.
Well, and the sergeants in the film, there's a number of sergeants in the film, and they're, Woody Harrelson is, at the time was in his 30s. Sean Penn, obviously, he's company sergeant. He was 38, so he was nearly 40. Yeah, Woody Harrelson was in his late 30s. And then another one was John C. Reilly, who had just broken out that year in the movie Boogie, or the year before in the movie Boogie Nights. I love John C. Reilly, great actor. He plays a sergeant. John C. Reilly kind of was born looking older than he is. And then another one was John Savage. And John Savage is actually the oldest actor, besides Nick Nolte, the oldest actor there. He was born in 1949. John Savage was in the movie The Deer Hunter in the 70s, and he was a close friend of Malick, and Malick specifically wanted him to be in this film. But I think it kind of goes back to your NCOs in a regular Army unit, like 25th Infantry Division, your NCOs would be older soldiers. They would be in their 30s, right? They would be old men, whereas maybe even just a year later or 2 years later, your NCOs would have come up with your regiments that were in your regiments and your divisions that were stood up in the post Pearl Harbor era. So,
yeah. And in fact, they don't show a lot of this in the book, but I mean, in the movie, but in the book, a lot of the men that start out this battle or this campaign, they start out as privates. By the end of the book, they're sergeants already, because so many of the sergeants get killed.
Yeah, and that's what happens in Man to Brothers with Easy Company.
Yeah. That they end up with 23-year-old sergeants or something.
Yeah. They were all young. But there's only a few. There's actually only a couple of junior officers would be platoon level officers, lieutenants that are shown in the film.
Right.
And only a few captains as well. So, and they're all young men. They're all younger than the sergeants, but that makes sense because they may have been West Point graduates or college graduates, who were assigned to this company, to this division.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
All right. So Sergeant Keck, that's Woody Harrelson. He's getting his squad ready. C Company charges. They attempt to take the hill, but they're, as the captain predicted, they're repelled by gunfire from the bunker. Many are wiped out. Among the first killed in the battle is the leader of the attacking platoon, Second Lieutenant White, spelled W-H-Y-T-E, and that's Jared Leto. And
yeah, future Oscar winner, Jared Leto.
Yeah, he just doesn't last very long.
I don't think he has any lines either.
No, he doesn't. He does a lot of hand waving. He's ordering people to go here and there. But yeah, poor Jared Leto. He doesn't get to be there very long. Anyway, during the battle, Witt, remember him? Remember Private Witt? And Witt is, you know, Jim Caviezel was probably 30-ish. He's the same age as me. And so he would have been pushing 30. And he's a guy that, as we said, Witt had been in the Army for 6 years and should have been a sergeant, but he just keeps getting busted. Anyway, he returns to the company. He asks Captain Staros if he can rejoin the company. Captain says, yes, you know, just get permission, whatever, that's fine. And so he's going to fight with him after all. Then Colonel Tall calls Staros and commends him for his leadership thus far. At first, he's very complimentary. He said, you did great. That was brilliant. He has this voice. But anyway, he orders him to take the hill by evening. The next morning, Japanese soldiers taunt the Americans, and they taunt them right back. Sergeant Keck and his men gradually approach the hill. They take heavy casualties. And then we have a very interesting scene where Keck, this grizzled old sergeant, Woody Harrelson's character, he's about to pull a grenade and throw it, but he pulls the pin out instead. And so the grenade's live, it's going to blow up. And if he had just kind of sat there and done nothing, it would have killed several people. But he jumps off to the side, he falls on the grenade, and he saves his men, but he dies soon afterward. He takes one for the team. And it's a very sad scene. And then we say goodbye to Woody Harrelson after what, Sean, 10 minutes or 15 minutes or so?
Yeah. Now the crew didn't, because he stayed for another month, but.
Yeah, exactly. But the character dies. Yeah.
Right. And a lot of
these guys just appear. They're there 10, 15 minutes and they're gone.
Yeah. And that speaks to the intensity of the attack action. And actually, John Savage's character, the sergeant that he plays, Sergeant Macron, he kind of flips out and he starts just ranting and raving. And they basically end up sending him back down the line without his weapon just to get him out because he's freaking out the enlisted men.
Yeah, and all those things did happen. I mean, I said, this movie is based on a book written by a man who was there and who saw all this stuff happen.
Right, and Malick did a lot of research on combat and spoke to combat veterans and did a lot of research on combat fatigue and on wounds and all kinds of stuff. So he immersed himself in that world. So it definitely comes out on screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the attack stalls out. One wounded American screams and cries out. He's giving away the American's position. Sergeant Welsh, again, that's Sean Penn, the old grizzled veteran. He risks his life. He runs over there. He gives the wounded man a lethal dose of morphine. And so that quiets the man down. And that's another ethical dilemma these guys faced is, what do you do when some guy either is hurt so bad and that he just can't stop screaming in pain, or some guy totally freaks out like Macron, like Sean was talking about. What do you do with these guys? There were cases where, this is rare, but there were cases where they would just shoot them. But more often than not, they would do other things. Of course, they didn't want to shoot their own men. In this case, they gave him this man. They figured he was dead anyway, so they give him too much morphine, and he dies of that. But yeah, then, go ahead.
Doesn't one of the medics try to go save him and get shot himself?
Yes.
Yeah, and Germans weren't as bad about this, although later they would do it. But Japanese especially were bad about shooting medics because the idea is you take out a medic, you take out multiple men that they may have saved.
Right. Then Colonel Tall gets on the phone. He calls Captain Staros again and he berates him for halting the attack. What are you doing? What are you doing just sitting there on your butts? I love the way Nick Nolte plays this character. The colonel orders Staros to send his whole company up the hill. I want to say it in his voice almost. It's so compelling. Yeah. But here we come to kind of a climax or a key moment in the film. Captain Staros finally refuses. He just says, I will not obey that order. I don't want to send my men to their death. The Japanese position is just too strong. He asks for permission to make a flanking movement, but Tall orders him to, again, go on, take it, head on assault, attack straight up the ridge. And Staros refuses. You know, he even notes the time. He says, I have two witnesses. And that's when Tall says the thing about, don't pull any of your courtroom lawyer tricks on me. But they finally reach an impasse. And Tall says, okay, fine, I'm going to come up there and see you. So he comes up and he joins Staros on the front line. He wants to see the situation for himself. But by the time he arrives, the Japanese resistance is lessened somewhat. And, you know, Tall is very skeptical about Staros's contention that it's too dangerous. He says, well, where's all the fire now? Well, it's the situation has changed, sir, he says. So Tall then orders a small detachment of men. He asks for volunteers to do a recon mission to kind of sneak around the side to determine the strength of the Japanese bunker. And then we're introduced to another character. We've seen him before, but now he really comes out as a main character. And that's Private Bell, another one-syllable name, played by the English actor Ben Chaplin. And he is the leader of the mission. And he starts to have flashbacks about his pre-war life with his wife. And that's kind of another one of the themes of the movie is relationships between people and who do you trust? Who do you give your love to? And Sean's going to talk about Bell a little bit more in a minute. He's a very interesting character, but I'll just finish out the thought. Bell goes up, he scouts out the bunker, and he reports back that there are 5 machine guns in the bunker, and he gets good info on it and gives them the means by which they might be able to take out the bunker.
Yeah, and I want to say, didn't Dahl and Bell, hadn't they already kind of found a way around a flank, like a ridge that was protected? And that was what Staros wanted to send a reconnaissance around to get.
I don't remember that, Sean. I don't think so, but.
Well, maybe. Yeah. But that's basically what they do.
I think, Sean, they saw one. There was a point where Dahl saw some Japanese soldiers running away from a position.
Right.
And he shoots one of them and makes a big deal out of it.
And that's what Staros, and that's what American fire and maneuver tactics during World War II were really supposed to be about. Small units, company and squad, you know, not even company level, but really squad level units making flanking maneuvers around 4 to 5 positions. No one.
We're talking like 12 guys on average.
Right. Because they had the experience the 20 years before in the First World War of sending units against fortified positions in frontal assaults. And what happens with those assaults? You die. You get killed. That's what happens.
Right.
So the whole thing that the Germans and the British and the Americans had developed in 1918 was infiltration tactics. It was a small unit infiltration fire maneuver tactics. And so Tall is not following sound military practice. Sound military practice is to probe and find a flanking position, an enfilade position to get around your enemy so that you can either kill them or force them off their position. That's the whole point. And the whole point of bunkers is to get close enough to bunkers to hit them with explosives and drive your opponent out. That's it. Staros is absolutely correct in his military, in his tactical assessment.
Which is ironic because he's a lawyer and he's the one who's got it all wrong is the career soldier.
And Tall is taking the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. He wants to get this assault done. And so he's willing to sacrifice. He said so in his narration, in his thoughts earlier, I will pour men on the ground like water. I will pour their blood on the ground to get what he wants. So Bell is played by Ben Chaplin, who's an English actor. I thought Ben Chaplin was going to be a much bigger star than he ended up being, but that's neither here nor there. He had been an officer. So in the scene in the ships, in the troop transport, he's talking to someone else. He'd been a lieutenant and an engineer. And I think he kind of, maybe the impression I got was either ROTC or West Point graduate or something like that. But he was an officer and an engineer, very intelligent. But he tried to resign from the army before the war because his wife could not stand for him to be away. And his wife's played by Miranda Otto. She's one of the few female parts in the film. And she, if you know Miranda Otto, she later was in the Lord of the Rings movie as Eowyn.
Yes, so my favorite, one of my favorite characters in my all-time favorite movie.
Right. So they were so in love, and she could not stand for him to be away. So he tried to resign, but the army wouldn't let him. They instead demoted him to private, and they put him in the combat infantry unit and told him, "You will be going into combat." So
there's a lot of really, really brief but passionate scenes between him and his wife, and tasteful. They're not rated R. Scenes, they're just kissing and touching and hugging and staring into each other's eyes, and he's pushing her on a swing at one point. It's beautiful. It really is.
Yes.
But it's ironic. He's so devoted to his wife and loves her so much. Well, we'll save the rest for later, but I imagine the people can probably figure it out if you haven't seen the movie. All right. Shall we go on to the next part?
Yep.
The colonel, he's kind of compromising a little bit with the captain. He says he asked for volunteers to conduct a flanking attack on the bunker the next day. So about 7 guys volunteer. Bell volunteers, Witt volunteers, several others. Dahl is one of them, the redhead. And then another one that now, here's another guy that just pops up. Oh, look, it's John Cusack. It's just kind of funny how these guys just pop up and disappear later. But it's almost like they're cameo roles. But
They are.
It's
an ensemble cast.
It is, yeah. And not very many of the actors start out at the beginning and make it through till the end. But Colonel Tall has an aide named Captain Gaff, played by John Cusack, and he's going to lead the attack. And so they go up there and they do have a fierce firefight, but they are able to use grenades and just small arms fire to take out the bunker. The operation is a success, and C Company stands poised to overrun one of the last Japanese strongholds on the island. And they start to do that. They capture several Japanese prisoners who are largely malnourished and dying. And of course, that's totally accurate. By the last couple months of the Battle of Guadalcanal, very few Japanese soldiers were in good shape. They were suffering from tropical diseases. They didn't have enough food. One of the officers, the Japanese officers, actually called Guadalcanal Starvation Island. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Colonel Tall praises Captain Gaff. He gives him command of B Company. He says, "You're like a son to me." He really likes Gaff. He thinks he's a lot better than Captain Staros. And Gaff insists upon water for the men. But Tall again, he says, "Oh, well, we got to keep attacking. We got to keep fighting right now. We can't quit while we're ahead, basically. We'll get the water later." And again, he says it right, straight out. He says, "His own career, my own career, my own reputation are at stake." That's not an exact quote from him, but then
Gaff kind of holds his ground and quietly kind of just stares at him. And he basically, and Tal's like, we'll get some water in here. We just got to keep attacking. Somebody go get the water. Mm-hmm. And so he basically, Gaff is able to get done what Staros was not able to get done and what Tal wasn't willing to get done, because Gaff actually knows he's got some power over Tal, because he's delivered Tal what Tal wanted. And now he's also a very humane person, in that he has the same feelings and instincts that Staros does, but because he's kind of a fair-haired boy in the company, and maybe he even has some connections with the regiment itself, and with the battalion, with regiment, maybe he's gonna cause Tall to rethink his intransigence in terms of getting the water to the men.
Yeah, and then they continue the attack. They keep marching along the ridge line, and this is a great battle sequence. So Sean and I were talking about this a few days ago. It's terrific combat, very realistic, very fast-paced and chaotic, just like it would have been in real life. And the Japanese are everywhere, and they're going every which direction. I mean, they're basically going forward, but they're just turning around and finding targets here and there, and they encounter a Japanese unit. And again, the Japanese are... they're rail thin. They look like human skeletons. Some of them are shaking from malaria. Some of them surrender. And it's just interesting, all the different reactions of the Japanese soldiers. Some of them just sit there on the ground. Some of them even look like they're meditating. Others are standing up and just saying things and kind of waving their arms. And it's very interesting. There's even one, a Japanese soldier leans over and just says something. You can tell it's not a friendly thing. He's looking very fiercely at one of the American soldiers, and he says something in Japanese. I looked it up. According to IMDb, what the soldier says is, "You are going to die one day too, just like this," or something like that. It's very interesting. So, but anyway, it's a fascinating sequence and very realistic, as I said.
And it's beautifully filmed, too. And
yes.
The cinematography is gorgeous. The scenery is beautiful. And that's the thing, is the juxtaposition of this beautiful paradise landscape where there's these explosions and gunfire and blood and viscera going everywhere. That's the tragedy of war, is that it despoils nature.
Yeah, it's one of the themes of the movie, is just kind of like the problem of evil. You know, there's talk about one of the first things that Private Train is not in the movie a lot, but he gets most of the voiceovers, and he says something like, "Where does this evil come from?" You know, and it's just really, it's amazing, these guys who are, they sound like they're from the hills of West Virginia or something, but they're coming up with all these profound statements. And I read somewhere, Sean, that some of these are actually quotations from poems and there's a lot of existentialist philosophy. There's some Sartre in it. There's some Heidegger, you know,
I'm sure there's some John Muir in there. So that's the thing. So Malick, you know, when he would talk to the producers and to the cast, he called war the green poison. And that was what he was trying to convey, was that, you know, Guadalcanal, this it was a paradise. It was an Eden. And the green poison was destroying, was killing it, and was killing the people, was killing the natural people that live there, was in destroying those who had come there as well. And so he wanted to show different, just like he wanted to show different perspectives and different reactions from the American soldiers, he wanted to show different perspectives and different reactions from the Japanese soldiers. Some are weeping. Some are stoic, some are meditating, some are sick and ill, some are angry. So that's what he wants. That's the violence. The violence is not the bullet going through the person. The violence is the nature of war coming, permeating everything in this environment.
The fact that there even is war.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like, where did we get this idea from? If this is God's perfect creation, then...
And that's what Welsh says, is this is, it's about real estate.
Right.
That's all it is. It's about an airfield. It's about an island.
Mm-hmm.
It's about an island that no one, you know, I read somewhere once, it's like some Japanese person had the crazy, the godforsaken idea of putting an airfield on this island. And now we've got to go and take it from them.
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to what Welsh is saying. All right, so let's move on to the next part. The next major part of the film is you get some kind of a little bit of release from the tension. You know, you've been going along with the guys in combat for probably 30 minutes or so total, and just all this shooting and all this chaos and everything. Oh, by the way, I noticed at one point during that last scene, Dahl stops and grabs a bunch of stuff from a Japanese command tent or something. I was thinking, man, you're such a thief.
Yeah,
he just takes everything. But now we go to some release. We've had tension. Now we have release. And so Colonel Tull, for the men's efforts, they've done such a great job. He gives them a week's leave. But then he goes up and sits down next to Captain Staros. And much to his surprise, the captain's surprise, Colonel Tull relieves him of his command. He says, you're just not tough enough. You're too soft-hearted. He's too soft for the pressures of combat. And he wants him to apply for reassignment, become a lawyer in the JAG at Washington. So, and he softens the deal by offering to recommend Staros for a Silver Star and a Purple Heart. And you can tell Staros is just really stunned and really disappointed. All Staros wanted to do was to win the battle. He wanted to fight, but he wanted to do it in a way that was sane and to protect the lives of his men. And for his efforts, he gets canned. Before he leaves, he visits several of his men, telling them they're like his sons. He says it to them in Greek. Oh, by the way, he says something in Greek earlier, too. This is one of the parts where Tall is commanding him to just march up that hill and take it. He says something, and I looked it up, and what he says is, the man's lost it. He's lost his mind, or something like that. But these men thank him for asking to make the flanking movement, you know, that for saving their lives. Dahl is one of the men. John C. Reilly's character, I can't remember the name of the soldier. But anyway, he gives them some booze
Storm,
that they
Sergeant
found.
Sergeant Storm,
thank you, yeah. And it's kind of a painful, it's a sad scene. And then you see Staros get on a plane, and that's it. So he's gone. And then we have a little bit of more scene with Bell. Bell writes to his wife, very passionate love letter, expresses his undying love for her. He talks to another soldier and says, I haven't been with another woman since I left. I haven't even looked at one. And But although he's been faithful to her, she has not been faithful to him. She receives a letter, or he receives a letter from his wife, Marty, informing him that she has fallen in love with someone else and she wants a divorce. And he's obviously devastated.
Yeah, she's actually fallen for an Air Force pilot, an officer, who's going to be shipped soon to combat in Europe. And so basically, she didn't want him to leave her and pressured him to quit the Army and to quit his officer position. His engineer position probably would have been not in a combat role. And they instead demote him, keep him in the Army, and he still loses her to a guy who's going to go off and fly over Germany. You know, so again, it's like you said, the war is a destroyer of these relationships between people as well. And right. Destroyer, you know, their love is depicted, and their love, and Bella's built up their love is pure and beautiful and worthy and everything and undying. And then again, that shattered as well.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Text the word BATTLES, BATTLES, to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. Lily in Tennessee lost 42 pounds with Calitrin. Jeff in Indiana lost 55 pounds. Beth said her joint aches have eased up considerably, and she is sleeping so much better. Text the word BATTLES, BATTLES, to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an amazing 86% success rate with their 90-day supply. And this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is so easy. Just text the word BATTLES, BATTLES, to 30605, and I'll send you a link to this special offer. You'll be glad you did.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Right. Meanwhile, the airfield where the men are resting comes under frequent Japanese artillery bombardment. The men are trying to get some rest and relaxation, but it's hard when you're constantly hearing shells going off, and they're just physically and emotionally spent.
Yeah, this reminds me of the South Pacific, you know, the James Michener book and the musical. But James Michener, who was in the rear area of the war, you know, he noted that the great enemy in the war is of most of these young men was idleness and boredom, rather than combat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that these men are, even if a week's leave, you know, they're wild animals in this, you know, even in the rear area, they're these wild animals, right, who just can't function at all. There was a scene in the HBO miniseries, The Pacific, that was really good, where they brought the veterans, the Marine Corps veterans from Guadalcanal back to Australia after the battle. And they put them up in this soccer stadium, and they all walk in, and their clothes are rags, and they're like all hunched over, and they all have malaria, and they just sort of just like drop to these benches of this soccer stadium, and some just sleep for like a week just out in the open.
Right. Yeah. It's, oh man, it's just unbelievable. But I had to think my dad went through this too. I mean, my dad was at Guadalcanal, and then he was evacuated afterward to New Zealand. And went through all this, but anyway, I'm getting off track. But anyway, so Then we have another interesting scene where we go back to Wit, and Wit runs across some of the Melanesian people, presumably the same people that he was with before. It's not completely clear. I didn't recognize some of the key people that he was with around at the beginning of the movie, but the point is he noticed they've become different. Whereas at the beginning, it just seemed like a paradise. You know, these Melanesians were obviously, they'd converted to Christianity. They were singing happily and clapping and going to church and just playing and swimming. And everything's just, at the beginning, at least, seems perfect. Although, of course, that's idealized. But now he sees that they're a little bit suspicious of him. Some of them have gotten sick. There's one little child who has pustules all over his back, and they show skulls and people now. And the men are fighting, and they don't really trust him. They don't come up to him anymore. And so that's just, I think that's symbolic of how the war has affected everyone, not just the people that are actually officially fighting the war, but the people who are having to be near the fighting, the people who live there. Yeah.
I mean, that's the central theme of the film. It's the despoiling nature of war. Paradise and community are destroyed by the green poison, Malik would
talk about. Yeah. All right, so we're going to part four, and this is the last part. I'm kind of amazed, Sean, at how quickly we're getting through this movie. It's just because it's almost 3 hours long, but I think half of that is just you looking at some person or some bird or some animal or something. I like the scene with the bats towards the end. That's pretty cool, but it's just so visual, and there's so many parts that are just nonverbal. It's just, I don't know, it's remarkable. But anyway. So the leave ends, the company is sent on patrol up a river, but now instead of Captain Staros, their leader is First Lieutenant George Band, played by Paul Gleason, and he doesn't really know what he's doing. It's very clear that he's not up to the job, but he was the next senior person after Staros. So they're going through this river, and then they start to hear Japanese artillery off in the distance. It's getting closer. Band orders several men to scout up river. Wit volunteers to go along, and they encounter an advancing Japanese column, and they're attacked. And one of the people that went with him was Corporal Fife, who is played by Adrian Brody. And this is a fascinating thing, because in the book, Corporal Fife, I think I mentioned this earlier, but Corporal Fife is the main character. He's huge in the book, and he is based on James Jones himself. But actually, go ahead and talk about, you had something about Adrian. Yeah, this is an interesting Brody, story from a meta standpoint.
He was much bigger part in the original, in an earlier cut of the film. Malik, he was the focus of the film. Malik told him he was going to be the one to carry the movie. And so much so, he was expecting to see this breakthrough role for himself. He flew his parents to the premiere. And that was when he learned when he was watching the film, his part had been reduced to two lines and 5 minutes of screen time. So he was pretty deeply embarrassed by that. However, it should be noted, the next year he starred in The Summer of Sam, Spike Lee's film about the Son of Sam murders. And then he won an Oscar a couple of years later for Best Actor for The Pianist. So Adrian Brody, I think, he did just fine from this film. He looks super young. He looks like a kid in this movie.
The Pianist is an amazing movie. I love that movie so much.
Yeah. And he does he's got those slick commercials where he walks around with looking like a rich fashion model. So,
but anyway, so just to reiterate what I was saying, the lieutenant orders Wit and Corporal Fife to go back to go check out the column. They're going to go inform the rest of the unit. And they do, they win. There's one other guy that goes, the other guy gets wounded and he's carried off by the river. But Wit sends Corporal Fife back to the main unit to tell them that the Japanese are coming and about how many there are and so on. But Wit stays behind, and Wit decides he's going to draw away the Japanese. He's going to distract them and kind of hold them off. He's kind of a one-man holding actions to give the rest of the unit time to get away. He's encircled by one of their squads. They demand that he surrender. This one soldier gets really close to him and starts shouting at him in Japanese. And I looked that one up too. I just had to know. And he says something like, "We don't want to kill you. You killed a lot of our people, but I don't want to kill you. Just surrender. Please surrender." And they demand that he surrender. And he's just completely blissful. He's calm. He has, Jim Caviezel just has this lonesome cowboy look to him. And he pulls that out. He looks at him. He's got those big eyes, and He raises his rifle and he's gunned down.
It's an ecstatic. It is the look of someone who's martyring themselves.
Yeah, he takes one for the team. And as a result, the company is able to retreat safely. He distracted the men enough. But we were talking about this earlier, Sean, and why don't you tell me what you said earlier? Because I was thinking, you know, he could have just stayed there even longer. He could have surrendered. And
right.
I don't know, maybe if he'd surrendered, the other guys would have run down and captured the rest of the company. I don't know. Why did he raise his rifle?
Well, you know, that's the thing is his character, Witt's character, is such a transcendental character that he seems to always be floating all above the surface, you know, of the ground. Like, he's beyond this world. He's got his mind in things beyond the here and now.
Yeah, and if I can break in, he's just, Jim Caviezel plays it perfectly. He's got this calm, peaceful look. He almost always has a smile on his face. He never seems stressed.
Right.
Amazing.
Right. And it's ecstasy. It's the classical sense of ecstasy. You know, when you talk about the martyrs, the look on their face, you know, and you read Fox's Book of Martyrs or something, that notion of ecstatic joy and bliss in leaving yourself and giving your life for what you believe in. And Witt believes in nature, in this world, and he believes in this company. And Welsh is the pragmatist. His perspective, and he said it, that the only way to get through this war, to get out of this war, is to know that you're already dead. And so whether you walk out on your own two feet or you're carried out, to accept and embrace your death, that you have no, in the most pessimistic manner, the most pragmatic manner, that's a survival tactic that Welsh has. And so Witt, I think, accepts that same thing, but for different reasons. Welsh it's a survival tactic. If you accept your death and you don't die, then you win, right? If you do die, then you've gotten what you expect. You can't be that broken up about it. From Witt's perspective, I think he is a Christ figure. He's giving his life for others to be alive and to give just one more second. Maybe the company will hear the shots. Maybe they'll pause. Maybe the Japanese won't move to the next position to go catch Corporal Fife and the rest of the company. All of those things you can infer and imply are going through Witt's head, and he's at peace with that. So like the Welsh is at peace with, Welsh is accepting of his eventual death, his probable death in this war. Witt is accepting that he can give his life for his brothers, for his company, and bridge that gap of unnaturalness with an unnatural act, but to be peaceful and accepting of it. And that's why I think he has that look on his face of calm and peace and ecstasy of happiness, of giving up his life to help his friends. And that's why he doesn't surrender. And that's the other thing, is he doesn't want to lose his freedom. He's run away from the army just to be free in nature. And so to surrender to the Japanese is just another way of not being free, and dying is a way to be free.
Hmm.
So deeply, I mean, these are, this is heady conversation, but.
Yeah, this is a little bit deeper than when we were talking about Midway, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So Jim Caviezel plays a Christ-like character, huh? That's hard to imagine.
Yeah, hard to imagine what he'll go on to do.
Yeah, take it to the next level. Just be Jesus.
Take it directly to the next level.
Right, that's right.
But not, I mean, when I saw the Passion of the Christ, and I totally was like, yeah, he'd be a good character, good person, good actor to play that part. I thought he'd be a good person to play that part because of his performance in The Thin Red Line. And his expressions, I mean, obviously his facial expressions are similar, but his acting choices as Jesus in The Passion of the Christ are very similar to his acting choices as Witt in the Thin Red Line.
Absolutely. Now, before we go to the last part, I have to back up and include something that I forgot to put in the notes, but there's a really great scene in the section where they're on leave, and Sergeant Welsh, Sean Penn, is kind of just chilling out in this hut, and Witt walks in and starts talking to him. And you remember that? Isn't that a great scene, Sean? And basically Witt says, well, why do you have to be so hard and tough? You know, why do you pretend like you, one time you know me and then you pretend like you don't know me? And and you know, of course, Welsh kind of, I can't remember what his exact words, but oh, there's a great line too where Witt says to Welsh, "Do you ever feel lonely?" And Welsh says, "Only when I'm around people." You remember that?
Yeah.
That's a great, yeah. And he's a loner. He's an individualist, and very important line. Witt says to Welsh, "I still see a spark in you." So he's kind of, and again, that's some of that Christ-likeness. He sees the best in him. He sees that Welsh is not just, you know, some kind of robot or some kind of killing machine. He's still a human being. I still see that spark in you. I think it's important that I bring up that line before we go into the next part. What, any comments on that scene in the hut?
No, I mean, that's the gist of it.
And there's a lot of flashbacks too, to the earlier scene. There was a flashback where Witt had been talking very early in the movie. Witt talks about his mother dying and how sad it was, but how much peace she has. And he says, "I hope that when I die, I go out like she does, with the same kind of calm and peace." And of course he does. But in that scene, they're inside of his mom's room and there's a bird cage. And yet there's a bird cage also in this scene in the hut with Welsh and Witt that brings back that. And they do this. There's even a similar pan, the camera pans to look at the ceiling. And that's just really neat. It's cool the way Malick is kind of preparing you for Witt's death. This obviously occurs before Witt goes out and gets killed, but he's preparing you for that by taking you back to that scene where Witt's mother had passed away and had done so with such grace and such calmness. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on to the final part of the movie. Well, the people find Witt's body and he's buried by Welsh and his squad mates, and they pay their respects and everything. And then they all leave, but Welsh stays behind. He pays his respects and he says to the now dead and buried Witt, he says, "Where's your spark now?" So he hasn't been saved. In other words, Welsh, Witt's nothing. Witt had, I guess, I don't know if he's beyond saving, or my point is that Welsh is still that. There's no spark in him, or if there is, it's he's buried it. He's covered it up because Welsh is still that cynical individualist that he was before. Then we go to the final scene, which is very interesting. The company gets a new commander named Captain Bosch, and it's George Clooney. George Clooney just magically appears, and he's the new captain. It's really interesting, and he gets a 5-minute period in the movie. And he's walking around. And he's giving this kind of bombastic and pompous lecture. He says, "I'm the father, and Welsh is going to be the mother, and we're going to do things my way, blah, 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 blah." And Welsh expresses cynicism in a voiceover. He gets a voiceover, and he says, "Oh, they just keep coming and coming." And it's the classic thing of the old grizzled sergeant who's been running the company, and he knows how things are, and here's another new officer telling us what we're going to do and all that. And finally, in the end, they march by a cemetery for American servicemen. They board a waiting LCT and they depart from the island. Private Train gets the final voiceover, and it's very philosophical, almost theological. He even says, like, "Oh, my soul," or something like that. And I can't remember exactly what he says, but I remember thinking, wow, that's really deep for a private who's obviously from, you know, the hills, or I don't know, he's from the country. And the final scene, Melanesian children row a canoe and the landscape is still beautiful as if nothing had happened. How about that, Sean?
I mean, that's, yeah.
Nature goes on. Nature
Nature will heal.
Humans can come and destroy, but eventually nature gets the last say, doesn't it?
Yeah, really. That's exactly it. I like the scene. I like George Clooney says, you think of me as your father and Sergeant Welsh as your mother.
Yeah. it's really interesting.
Yeah, he had a very small part. He had wanted a bigger part, but it was, you had ER to do and things like that. So, you know, they made sure to get him in this. So, yeah.
I have to mention before I'm turning it over to you again for your kind of bring it in for landing as you usually do, but the soundtrack, the soundtrack is simply amazing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's perfect. It's suspenseful when it needs to be. It's just, but not too much. You know, some of the movies we're going to discuss, the soundtrack is just, it's too much. It's overbearing, but not here. It's just perfect.
Yeah.
All right. So what about the cast? What is there to say about this cast, Sean?
What a cast. I mean, you've got a bunch of huge stars, Sean Penn, Woody Harrelson, John Cusack, John Travolta, Nick Nolte, George Clooney. And then you've got a lot of respected character actors at the time, John Savage, Tim Blake Nelson, Donald Logue. He has a very small part. Elias Koteas, And then you've got some big stars that are coming in the future. Adrian Brody, Jared Leto, who both won Oscars, Jim Cazaville, Nick Stahl, John C. Reilly, Thomas Jane. He has a very, you blink and you miss Thomas Jane. Mark Boone Jr., who's in Sons of Anarchy and has been in a couple episodes of The Mandalorian. He's always plays a big grizzly bearded biker guy. He's a young guy, a young soldier without a beard in this somewhere in the film. So just a great cast. And again, like we said, the cast of people who wanted to be in the film is even bigger than the cast itself.
Yeah, I saw you can go onto YouTube and search for deleted scenes. And yeah, there's one scene with Mickey Rourke in it. That was pretty cool.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Mickey Rourke, they did film a scene with him. You know, when they were doing the casting, apparently Martin Sheen helped Terrence Malick. He read lines with the actors who were coming in to be cast. Sean Penn went into the editing room with Terrence Malick as he was editing the film to help him make editing choices. So, and Sean Penn, would later go on to direct some films himself. So,
Clooney,
really great movie.
George Clooney directed some films, didn't he?
George Clooney wrote and directed as well. So I saw this film in 98 before general release, right immediately before general release. Malick was very prickly about it. The producers showed a version, an unfinished version to critics, and he got really upset about that. And so he took the film and recut it again to make the final movie. It took him 3 months, and he cut 45 minutes out of his initial cut. Most of it was probably Adrian Brody's parts. He wouldn't do any more test screenings. So I got to see, right, like the maybe 2 or 3 days before general release, I somehow managed to wind up with a press pass to see it with the press in Dallas. And I actually, Mike, who's my co-host, one of my co-hosts on the Come and Take It, we went and saw the film. And a reporter asked us what we thought. And I said, Malick is back. It's fantastic. But yeah, I think that this movie, I know you like it a whole heck of a lot. I really like the movie. I think it's one of the best made movies ever. And it's very thoughtful and deeply contemplated film. I don't know that it's as watchable as Saving Private Ryan. So Saving Private Ryan came out around the same time from Steven Spielberg, set in Normandy, obviously. I think Private Ryan is a much more visceral film experience. It's also a more Hollywood film, but that makes sense because Steven Spielberg is kind of the uber Hollywood director. So there's scenes in Saving Private Ryan that are very Hollywood scenes, like the scene where Tom Hanks shoots the pistol at the tank and then the Mustang flies over and blows it up. And there's some sequences that are like, that's really Hollywood. This, who knows if that would really happen. There's not so much of that in The Thin Red Line. It's much more intellectual, much more contemplative. But I think the opening 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan is probably the most visceral and impactful war film sequence I've ever seen in any film ever. And as an action movie and as a movie, I think Private Ryan has my personal preference over this film, but they're just two different films. They just happen to have both be at the same time about World War II.
All right. So now we come down to the part of the podcast where we rate the movie on a scale of 1 through 5. Sean, are you going to say?
It's a 4.5 in the sense that it's not my favorite movie. It is difficult to watch at times. It's just, there are times when it's plotting for a reason, and there's times when it just moves slow. I think the middle act is phenomenal. That's a definite 5 stars. But some of the filming of trees gets a little tedious after a little while. So,
this is the first one I've been tempted to go with a 5, but I'm going to go with 4.5 as well, and I'm going to dock it points for. I just find it a little too philosophical at times. It just seems like, again, these good old country boys are going to be really quoting from Heidegger or something. Is that,
they're going to be thinking these deep thoughts. It gets high marks for Kraft. It gets extremely high marks for Kraft as a film.
Yeah.
Watchability is where, to me, is where it kind of loses a little bit. Whereas Private Ryan, I would always give a 5-star to Private Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is remarkable.
All right. Unfortunately, we will not be doing that in this series, but Sean and I have already talked about the possibility of doing a European theater series as well. So we'll see. All right. So that wraps it up. Now, our first 4 movies were almost entirely about air and sea combat. This was our first movie with ground combat, But we're going to leave the ground again, and we're going to do, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to do a mini series of purely naval movies. And these are different from the ones we've done, in that they are, there's not a lot of combat in these movies coming up. They're a lot about, what was it like to be a sailor? We've touched on already the long hours of boredom and all that. And so we're going to see that explored in a trio of films. All three of them were made in the 1950s. All three of them starred just absolute Hollywood legends: Humphrey Bogart, Clark Gable, Henry Fonda. And they're just delightful movies all. And so we're looking forward to that. So we'll start next week with the 1954 classic, The Caine Mutiny. We'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen, and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lem, and Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works. And Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Alex Calabrese, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Michael Fain, Scott Hendricks, Who's Your Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.